Welcome to the Frommer Travel Show. I'm your host, Pauline Frommer, and it's been a big week for travel news. My next guest has been on the front lines reporting it. She is Elaine Glusak. She is the Frugal Traveler reporter for the New York Times. And Elaine, I guess the question I have to lead with is it the end of credit card loyalty perks?
It's a scary question, isn't it? For those of us that really enjoy all of our free flights and hotel stays. It's not, to be clear, and things are not, haven't been approved by the courts yet, but there's been an agreement by Visa and MasterCard to settle a sort of longstanding 20-year suit in which merchants are trying to reduce the fees that they pay them for each transaction. So they came up with this agreement that's valued at approximately $30 billion for over the 5 years of its term. And then the thinking as far as travelers go and those of us concerned about our points is whether if the banks aren't getting those funds, how are they going to make up for it? Are they going to take away our perks and points? So those are some of the issues that we are looking at.
Let me just ask you, you didn't talk about this in the article, but I know that in Europe, the amount that banks can get from local merchants is much lower than it is here. Do you know, do they have the same ability over there to collect loyalty points? I mean, I'm wondering if that scenario has affected them and if we can look at them to see what's coming down the road.
Yeah, that's a very good question. I haven't done much reporting on that. I understand they do not have the kinds of programs that we have. We have these very lucrative programs with these, especially if you have one of those very expensive cards, like if you're spending $500 and more on a card, you're getting like 3 points for every dollar that you spend dining out, things like that. And I do not think that they have that, but I don't want to call me out.
Sorry.
On that.
Yeah, I surprised you with that. Well, to piggyback on that, those very expensive cards, I didn't realize this. This was a shocker in your article. They charge higher fees to merchants too, not just cardholders. And so merchants could end up charging people who have those cards more for their services and goods, right?
That's right. And that's part of this agreement. If it's approved, that there, you know, the scenario is potentially if you're paying with one of these really expensive cards, maybe your, you know, total is different than it would be if you paid with one of these basic cards, which of course would be very upsetting to the public. And so some experts think merchants won't do that because they're afraid of consumer backlash, but we don't know. It could happen.
So we're looking at potentially these cards having penalties attached to them if you try to use the really expensive ones that used to carry a lot of perks. And we're also looking at the banks making less money, so they could potentially pull some of those perks and in terms of loyalty points at hotels, at airlines. When would all of this hit if it did hit? And what should consumers be doing now that they know this news?
Yeah, there's it's unknown, of course, when exactly this will be approved. It needs to be approved in federal court. And the credit card companies say that could be late 2024 or early 2025. There's disagreement in the market about what will happen. Will this happen immediately? You know, banks know that, you know, really have the public on the hook and know that people love these cards. And so there's a lot of talk about, well, they'll be able to make up the money somewhere else. I don't know how. I think it's reasonable to expect that some of these programs will be a lot less lucrative than they were now.
And I want to say that you interviewed Brian Kelly, the points guy, and he thinks these programs are going to have to change.
Yeah, he said it's possible, which I really appreciate Brian's candor on that. You know, he's really an expert in the field and he sort of taught all these points hawks how to do it. And so I will say that he also told me he's not losing sleep over this. He thinks that there's a lot of power in the market. It's very big. But, you know, of course, this is his industry as well. And I will say finally that the points experts do all say, whatever you do, don't sit there and look at your balance and say, oh, I have 5 trips to Hawaii banked here. You got to start taking them because they lose value. The airlines start raising the amount it takes to get to Hawaii, for example. And so they lose their value. So you're really better off using them as soon as you have them.
Yeah, I think that's the takeaway for this. You say in the article that why wait around? If you have these points, use them. You also had a really terrific article about sustainability when you are booking a vacation rental. How do you have a green vacation rental experience? And I thought it was interesting. You go through the major sites where one books vacation rentals, and some of them are making it easier for the public than others. Like if you go to Airbnb, what do they do to help people figure out which vacation rentals are green?
Yeah, I do appreciate Airbnb's search filter. So they have these categories of homes. Like if you're really into cooking, they'll have like chef kitchens or something. But in terms of people interested in sustainability, they have things like off the grid, which would be like solar powered homes or maybe homes without electricity. And then they have something called earth homes, which are like made with ram dirt. And, you know, they're all really, really funky and just really fun to go shop for without any dates in mind. It's really fun to go look at them. So they have a lot of options there. They are one of the easier sites to navigate.
Booking.com also seem to be okay in terms of their categories. They help a bit.
They do. And Booking.com is really working on their system, and they sort of had a system of self-reporting, and they just got rid of that. So they sort of took the greenwashing out of the system, and they are looking, they are listing properties that have third-party sustainability certification. So it's more meaningful if it says that it has their sustainability certification now.
And you talk about a company called Sustainica, which I guess is the gold standard for these types of certifications.
Yes. And there's so few. That's the problem, really. Yeah. For us as consumers, there's just not that many resources. So Sustainica took it on, and they will, you know, they certify, they don't say that we give you a badge or anything, we're certifying you, and they have sort of lists of best practices, and their label, the problem is they're not a search engine, so you kind of have to look for their logo at like booking.com or Airbnb, but it's worth looking for those. It's a pretty good.
And I cut you off, but you were about to say that VRBO, also known as Vrbo, although I have trouble calling it Vrbo, that just bums me out. But VRBO has washed their hands of this. They think it's such a wild west that they don't want to be responsible for saying a property is green or not, right?
That's right. They're like, we don't think that there's enough vetting in the market for us to really say which of our properties is eco-certified. Expedia does have an eco-certified filter. When I played with it, a lot of it was hotels, but there are some rentals on there. And, you know, the bottom line for travelers is just like, I think anyone looking for a vacation rental knows they're going to spend a lot of time online, like searching through listings.
Sure.
You can look at that as fun. I do enjoy it to a certain extent, but this is like almost a next layer. Like then you're going to have to start asking questions and searching the photos and seeing, you know, and asking, do you have recycling? You know, what do I do with the compost? So,
right. I mean, you recommend if you're really serious about this, you first look for the certifications, but then you have to be proactive about reaching out to the hosts and making sure that this isn't greenwashing.
That's right. And the, you know, hosts that are on the forefront of this say it's really worth the effort and are calling on the public really to do this because just the act of asking a host might get them to do something. If they think the public is interested in this, perhaps that'll, you know, light the flame.
Yeah. And then you end the article with something I'd never even thought of before, I'm ashamed to say, when I've done a vacation rental, which is the issue of food waste. We know that a lot of the carbon that goes into the atmosphere has to do with food decaying. And so what do you do when you buy all these supplies and you don't use them? And how do you mitigate your food waste? What are some strategies?
Yeah, I mean, I really think that's one of the very biggest issues for people that are traveling in these short-term rentals, because, you know, you have a kitchen and you're going to buy, you know, even if you're eating out a lot, you're probably going to have some meals in. So the first measure is to not buy too much. Maybe, you know, don't do a big shop for the whole week that you're at the beach. Maybe just, you know, go day by day or every other day and shop as you go. That way you'll have less waste. You'll also have fresher food, which is good. Honestly, sure, it'll take more time, but maybe you're in some place like Italy and going to the market is really great, you know?
Yeah, fun.
Yeah. And then, you know, just, you know, obviously using leftovers, but then finding places to donate them. This can be really hard. If you're driving, certainly take everything as much as you can. So much food, hosts have told me, hosts and platforms have told me, are left behind and the cleaners don't want them, or they can't keep them cool enough, they, you know, in their car or whatever. And so it's, you might think that you're doing a nice thing, but it's probably going to get thrown out. So, you know, finding a food pantry, a donation center or something like that is...
Or knocking on the neighbor's doors and saying, do you want something? Actually, when this summer we rented a boat that we drove down a barge in France, and a canal in France, I should say. And the boat next to us gave us a whole lot of supplies when we were about to go shopping. So it was very, very helpful. So,
yeah, I rented one of those camper vans. And when I went to pick it up, they had like a whole shelf of like food that was left over from people who had done camping trips. And I was so outfitted. So if you're renting a camper van, call them up and say, hey, do you guys have a food donation shelf? I got like chicken stock, vegetables. I mean, there was even beer.
Wow.
Firewood.
Lucky you. Well, two great articles. Thank you so, so much, Elaine, for appearing on the Frommer Travel Show.
Oh, thanks so much, Pearlene, for having me back. Appreciate it.
Next guest is a cruise expert, and she's going to discuss cruising to an area of the world that I think a lot of people assume you can't cruise in. I'm speaking about both India and Heidi Sarna. She wrote a terrific article for Frommers.com called Four River Cruises in India That Will Wow You. Hey, Heidi, welcome back to the Frommer Travel Show.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
So, first of all, when we were talking about this, you mentioned that your husband is of Indian descent. Is that how you knew that rivers in India would be a good bet?
Yes, I think that it's how it started. I've traveled to India many times over the last 30 years. And so I would say more knowledgeable about India, and began, you know, doing more research and traveling around the country and learning about the Kerala backwaters first. And of course, everyone has heard of the Ganges River, or the Ganga, as an Indian would say. And then, yeah, I looked into like, can you cruise on these rivers? And you can. And so that's how it started.
And what makes cruising in India different than cruising in other parts of the world? Or why is this a smart way to get around India?
Well, India is a vast country in size. It's about a third of the area of the United States. So one reason it's a large place. The second is traveling in India can be challenging. There's railways, but trains can take a long time.
Sure.
The roads are a little scary. They're getting better, but depends on your threshold for sort of a bit of chaotic driving style. And, you know, India has more than a billion people. Certain areas are just packed with people, and that can be intimidating, and the heat, different things. So a river cruise or a Kerala backwaters cruise just sort of takes down the chaos a few notches, but yet you're able to travel in such an amazing place. There's so much to see in India. So a river cruise is just sort of ideal in so many ways. You have your calm floating home base to come back to at the end of each tour. You know, and it's moving to the next place, and you see the river life, and then you're also touring by day. So it's just supremely convenient, especially in a place like India that's can be challenging.
Sure. I think challenging is a good word. And the first time I was there, my husband got very, very ill, which I think happens to people sometimes. There can be different things in the water, different. Yeah. I actually heard that if you drink Pepto-Bismol or chew it before a meal, it will coat your stomach and stop any bacteria from lodging there and making you sick. I don't know if you've ever heard that or tried that.
I don't know. I just avoid, I've gotten sick once or twice over the years, but in my like 50 trips to India, mostly I'm fine. And you just really do avoid anything that could have been washed with water. Like, do not have salads, you know, like, obviously don't drink the water that it's not bottled. But on all the river cruises I've been on, four different ones so far, you know, they're supremely clean and efficient. They know their market is foreigners. So I've never seen, I mean, people do get sick, but I've never really seen it. I just find it's a really safe way to travel. Water is obviously bottled and that's what's used for the cooking. But I still avoid salads and things that might've been washed.
Smart. So when people think river cruises, they often think Viking, maybe they think Uniworld or AMA Waterways. Are those the companies that are plying the Indian rivers, or are there different local companies that do it?
So mostly it's local companies that run the cruise lines and have built the boats, the river boats. And then companies like Uniworld, as you mentioned, for instance, they'll charter in part or in full and sell them on their website. So you can go to Uniworld and see a Ganga river cruise or Hooghly, but they're using a company's ships called Antara. So what I do like is that, as I just said, that they're India-based companies. So one is called Assam Bengal Navigation. I was recently just cruised with them on the Hooghly River. And Antara, I just mentioned, that's an Indian company, but they charter their ships to some of the brands that you mentioned in the U.S. Pandaw is another company that has some boats in India. And again, sometimes, you know, there's chartering and relationships, obviously, so that are quite normal. And that happens.
Is the experience, though, different on these boats? You know, river cruising in Europe, I think kind of as an activity that can be done by people who have disabilities, people who might be slow walkers or older. Is that the same in India, or would that make shore excursions too difficult there?
Yeah, there's definitely would be more challenges. I'd say first, just finishing the other ideas, because the boats are built and run by Indians who live there, they're super familiar with the area, you know, so you're not bringing in a European cruise director or something. Sure. So that helps in terms of even helping passengers navigate the gangways and things. And, you know, they speak the language. English is spoken in India to a large degree, but not by everybody. But yeah, I would say there's more challenges with wheelchairs and that sort of thing. There aren't like a lot of river boats. Some have elevators, but the India river boats, I haven't seen one that has an elevator, for instance. So you'd have to be able to navigate one or two flights of stairs. You'd have to be able to get into tuk-tuks. Those are those small motorized sort of like golf cart type conveyances. It wouldn't be good for walkers and wheelchairs. Definitely not. Definitely canes. People have canes and they can get around. You would need to be a little fitter or resilient, a little hardier, I would say, for India. There are people that were in their 70s and 80s on the river cruises I've been on. So, you know, age isn't a limiting factor necessarily. It just depends on your comfort level, I would say.
Well, let's talk about some of the rivers that you can go on and why you would go on one versus another. Obviously, as we discussed before, the most famous river in India is the Ganges. You gave an alternate pronunciation. What is the Indian pronunciation for it?
Ganga.
Ganga. Okay. Why should you pick the Ganga?
It's the most famous river in India, of course. It's worshipped by Hindus. It starts, the source is up in the Himalayas. It comes all the way down through the plains and eventually hits the Bay of Bengal. The Hooghly River, which I was just on, is a tributary of the Ganges. So the reason you go on any river cruise in India generally is to see temples, you see pastoral areas, farms, and local villages. So they all sort of offer that. There's fewer opportunities on the Ganges because of river levels. So you can really do the Ganges mostly toward the end of its route toward Calcutta.
Right.
But you would do it to see Varanasi is a famous, sort of the famous spiritual center of India. Some Ganges cruises can go as far as Varanasi down to Calcutta, which is by the Bay of Bengal.
And Varanasi is a city that's famous for its death rituals, right? Yeah. I mean, do people see those from the boats?
Yeah, so only a few can go up that far, again, because the river levels can really fluctuate. So some actually take you there by train. So that's sort of what they don't point out on their website so much. But Assam Bengal Navigation, ABN, for instance, that company, they can cruise all the way to Varanasi. And part of what they offer is a morning sail. The crews, the captain will get the ship going at dawn to go near the ghats and to see the death rituals, as you mentioned. And ghats are, that's the name for the steps that sort of come into the water where people gather, like you said, for death rituals, but also for cleansing. And yeah, so you're right there on a few of the boats seeing this in action. And it's quite, you know, it's quite dramatic. Something, yeah. Not everybody maybe wants to see it, but for those who do, it's just so fascinating, yeah.
Wow. And you just were on the Hooghly. Why would one pick that river? What are the top sites?
So what makes the Hooghly convenient, again, it's a tributary of the Ganges, of the Ganga, but it's the cruises start or end in Calcutta. So what's neat is you can stay on a few days in Calcutta, which is definitely a city worthy of a few days, you know, in a hotel and doing some tours. So the Hooghly is a relatively short spur of the Ganges, maybe 200 or 300 miles total. And the river cruise about 200 miles from Calcutta, which is near the ocean and the Bay of Bengal upstream. So it's just this one patch. And, you know, British India started in Calcutta. The British came first to the eastern parts of India. So you have some of the British heritage. There's a lot of British passengers that come on India River cruises because of the connection to the colonial days. And then you also see Mughal, Indo-Islamic architecture and ruins from the 12th and 13th century. So you see, you know, there's so much. You see Hindu temples, 300-400-year-old, and you see some mosques, you see some relics from the British days, some old mansions and things. There's still a lot, you know, there's a lot of farming that you can see in different places. Village walks are popular. There's industry. You know, you really get it all on the Hooghly, I have to say. And then, like I say, staying a few days in Calcutta was also a high point of the trip. It was really, really fascinating place.
Now I hope I get the pronunciation of this right, the Brahmaputra River.
Yeah,
why do people take journeys on that river? What are the draws?
So the Brahmaputra is up in the northeast in a state called Assam. So they're definitely, so as the Hooghly is more culture and history, there's some of that on a Brahmaputra, but mostly the Brahmaputra, the draw is wildlife and the landscape. So there's a famous wildlife preserve called Kaziranga that is accessed via the Brahmaputra, and they're famous for the one-horned rhinos.
Oh, wow.
So yeah, so you always spend a day on those cruises. You spend a day in this park, which is, you know, very close to the river. You don't have to travel too far. And yeah, I did it. You see many rhinos. So it's not like, oh, maybe we'll see one rhino today. You really see a lot of them.
Huh. Are they endangered or no?
You know, again, you're with local guides and they seem to know, just like when you're on an African safari, you know, don't get too close. Don't jump out of the Jeep, but.
Oh, actually, I said endangered, not danger.
Right. Yeah, exactly. But you know, there could be dangerous. But yeah, they're smaller than the African rhinos.
And you've heard me wrong twice. Not are they dangerous, but is the species endangered? Are they?
Yeah, overall, the numbers have gone down, but Kaziranga claims to have the most one-horned rhinos in that park. So, so you can't see them very many places. They are endangered. Yes, sorry.
Right. No, that's okay. Fascinating. So it's almost like a safari via river cruise. Why you do that one.
Absolutely a safari.
And many years ago, I did the backwaters of Kerala. I found it rather dull. I got to be honest. Maybe I didn't do it in the right way, though. Why do people, and I had heard from so many people that they loved it. So I'm hoping you can give another perspective on it. We only did it for, I think, 2 nights, which felt like more than enough.
So yeah, that's interesting. So that the sort of typical Kerala backwaters cruise is 1 or 2 nights. A lot of hotels have riverboats, either they own them or they, you know, are connected to them and their guests do them. And I would say those are more dull because they're larger and they don't go very far. So they're just floating around sort of a few basic areas and you see tropical, you know, trees and things. But what I did, there's not as many that do week long. So I was on a boat called the Vaikundam, 18 passengers. So they offer something different, more in depth, 1 week. So you go into smaller tributaries and canals, which you would not do in the kind that you did. And sure. The canals were quite interesting. You know, the farm is right there, the people are right there, you know, the villages, and you could just see close up what's happening. But there were daily tours, which again, I don't think you get on those 1 and 2 nighters, which is mostly floating around. But we, you know, we did bird watching, and there's so many birds in Kerala. It's crazy if you're a bird watcher. But we would get off. We had meals in local homes.
Wow.
You know, walked through the rice plantation, the rice fields. We went to the beach at one point. Like, that was a car ride, but you know, you're near the coast, so that was fascinating. Many temples. So yeah, it's quite different. If you really are interested, I would recommend doing the week and not so much the 1 and 2 nighters are relaxing if that's what you're after. But if you want more culture and activities, definitely do something longer like the one I experienced.
Yeah, I had a 14-year-old and a 10-year-old with me. So it was not relaxing to be on a little boat that had nothing much to do on it except watch the, you know, tropical scenery pass by.
Yeah, that doesn't sound very fun.
No, we played a lot of board games and cards, and I wrapped myself in two to try and keep them busy. And the interesting thing to me about Kerala was I hadn't been to southern India before. I'd only been in the north, and it's far more prosperous than the north. I mean, I found it to be when I was there, and I was also in, oh my goodness, is it Kochi? The city?
Kochi or Cochin, yeah.
It just wasn't, it felt like the kinder, gentler India.
Yeah.
You didn't see as much deep poverty as you do elsewhere. And so I think maybe it's a better beginner India place. I don't know.
Right. No, in that way, you're right. It's prosperous, and the South really focuses on education more, and they're very proud of that. And the literacy rates are higher. Like you say, you don't see beggars very often, and that's
right.
I mean, in that way, I agree. But I would say that, you know, you don't see some of the architecture that you see in other parts of India down in the South. So, you know, it's just different. I mean, you probably remember the Chinese fishing nets, as they call them, were quite fascinating in the Kerala area with those huge wooden bamboos and the nets, and done a very primitive way, these giant.
Right. People throwing these or lowering these massive nets into the water to catch fish.
Yeah, they're quite fascinating. So in a way, I agree with you, but in a way, I feel like you're missing out. If you just go to Kerala, you're missing out, you know, on that architecture that you see in the north.
And the colonial history and, you know, the fascinating temples. That's the thing about India. Each section is, each area is so different one to the next, because these were different principalities and nations until not that long ago, you know, until they were forced together by the British.
Right. There's just so many layers. And the Mughal history, you know, from the 15th and 16th century that, you know, gave us the Taj Mahal and so much of the beautiful architecture with the Persian influences in the Northeast, but you also see some of that in the East as well. So, yeah, and then the British came and did their thing. There's just so much there. And then, you know, and then there's temples from 1,000 years ago.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, extraordinary sights you see in India. And I always found just the people were so welcoming and kind to us. I mean, it's a wonderfully friendly place to visit, yeah. I've always found. Well, one last question. I'm assuming that booking these river cruises, you do it in the same way you'd book any river cruise, right? Or is there any difference in the booking process?
I mean, you can book direct, but unlike Europe, which, you know, for North Americans would be easy to go on a website with Uniworld or AMA, for instance, India, definitely most people are going through a tour operator. So, you know, the tour operator would book their Brahmaputra cruise with one of these companies, and then also help them, you know, with some hotel nights before or after.
Sure.
Most people do not go to India for 1 week, you know, I mean, you can. But most stay for another week or two and travel around the country. So in that way, usually people are dealing with a travel agent or an operator that helps them arrange the whole thing.
Right, right. Well, that makes sense. Well, it's been a delight speaking with you as always. And as I said at the beginning, Heidi has a complete article on this on Frommers.com, which is really, really helpful and gives you a lot of the details we weren't able to go into. Thank you so much, Heidi, for appearing on the Frommer Travel Show.
Thank you. Hope to see you again.
And that's it for this week's show. I thank you so much for listening. And to those who are traveling, may I wish you a hearty bon voyage.